Welcome to Hazel's Story, an epic saga podcast. We're here to dive deep into the panels and pages of Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples' comic book masterpiece, unpacking the amazing characters, themes, and weirdness of this grand space opera. I'm Alan.
And my name's Abu.
And we made it!
We did it!
This is the final chapter of the new story arc, chapter 60, the last chapter in what will eventually be a volume 10 collection. Starting this off, when we got our first new chapter, who knew that we would have so many twists and turns to get here, but here we are.
Yeah, what a ride it's been with these new chapters. But before we slip up and say too much, folks, huge spoiler warning. As the title states, we are talking about chapter 60 today, the brand new chapter this month. And so that means if you are not all the way caught up, including chapter 60, you should stop listening right now, go get caught up, and then come back and listen.
Okay, with that spoiler warning out of the way, and really seriously, chapter 60 has some doozies in it. So if you are not totally caught up on 60, stop right now.
Yeah.
Everybody else, before we get into this chapter, just a reminder that we want to know what you all think of these new chapters of Saga and this whole new story arc that will constitute Volume 10. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about a fan theory from the Saga comic book Facebook group, and we'd love to know what you all think of it after you hear us talk about it, whether you're in that Facebook group or not. A little shout out to Zach McLernan, the admin of that group. Thanks for all your hard work, Zach. You run a great group.
Yes, indeed. And actually, dear listener, we need your help as well, because we won't be getting brand new chapters of Saga until January of next year. Fiona and Brian are going on an extended break now that Chapter 60 has been released and Volume 10 is done. So, in the interim, we want to try and experiment with different kinds of episodes on this podcast, and we want to hear from you what you would want us to dive into. Is there a favorite character that you think deserves a deep dive episode? Do you think we should investigate a certain species in the universe or some other vague lore detail? Let us know. Send all of those fan theories to hazelsstory@loreparty.com. Don't forget the two S's in the middle.
We've gotten a lot of great ideas. We've had some emailed in by listeners like Bailey and Al and Xavier, but we want more. We need more fodder for the Hazel Story machine. So let us know what you are interested in hearing, and we'll share your idea and just continue forth into this new world of no more new chapters.
Yeah, it's going to be a long one. We have to wait again. I feel like Saga fans at this point are pretty good at waiting.
Yeah, just as a reality check, because there's been some folks very mad about this extended hiatus. Brian and Fiona have always taken a break between arcs. It's just usually 3 to 4 months, not 6. So it's a little longer. It's not like this is totally unprecedented. Just as a caveat for Brian and Fiona.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's talk about today's episode, because things are a little bit different. A reminder, though, as usual, this is not a deep dive episode. This is our first reactions and instant takeaways to this brand new chapter that only recently came out. So expect our conversation today to be a little looser, definitely less organized, and a lot more geeky and excited. And we have a special surprise.
That is right. We have changed things up. It's not just me and Abu that are going to offer our reactions to Chapter 60 and actually the entire Volume 10 story arc.
Ooh.
We have a special guest on this episode who we will tell you all about and you will get to hear from right on the other side of this quick break, where we'll introduce our guest and get down to the business of discussing this very fun and very intense Chapter 60 of Saga. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. So with us today is someone who is no stranger to thinking and writing about Saga. Jordan Calhoun is the editor-in-chief at Lifehacker and The Takeout, and also author of the recently released Piccolo is Black, a memoir of race, religion, and pop culture. He also has a very good newsletter from The Atlantic called Humans Being, where he writes about pop culture and games and TV and just all sorts of fun stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the very first editions of that newsletter, Jordan, you wrote was entitled Why You Should Read Saga Aside from Me Begging You. So clearly you're a Saga fan. We're here at chapter 60 of this book, and we would love to know, what was your sort of first reaction to Chapter 60, and maybe also the arc of new chapters from 54 to 60 since the book came back from hiatus.
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. Thanks for that generous introduction. I am really happy with this arc and how I think Brian K. Vaughan is very good at emotional pacing. Mm-hmm. So I would juxtapose this against a very recent thing that I've just finished watching a week ago, which was Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. A show like Stranger Things, the emotional high point is always happening, which means that there's not an actual emotional high point. It's always on 10. There's always some like dramatic scene that's supposed to have some type of emotional resonance. Mm-hmm. BKV does something different in this issue and in this past arc, where the culmination of this issue, and I assume that we're talking spoilers candidly, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, openly, yep.
So the culmination of this issue is obviously, you know, Hazel losing her shit over these memories of her dad dying. Mm-hmm. And that was the type of emotional height that I think many lesser writers would have started with. Mm. You know, after Marco dies at the end of 54, you would expect to come back and to have the emotional weight of the comic be based in what our emotional reaction was, which is, oh shit, Marco just got killed, yeah. Right? Like, this is a big deal. Instead, BKV does the opposite, where he's not only downplaying Marco's death in the beginning, like both to audiences and to the characters within the show, but they're like actively shitting on Marco. They're like pissing on his grave. They're having right. sex, making fun of him.
Yeah.
They're carrying around his skull. They're crushing his skull to do a magic spell. They're completely dismissing him as this unimportant character, even though we know he's important. And eventually, like, the prestige of it all, the trick of it, is that you just start to go with what the characters are portraying. And then it's not until the end, or this most recent issue, mm-hmm. where you're like, oh no, it was just as big a deal as I thought it was. It just is showing up now in this climactic scene. So I think it was really good emotional pacing to sort of downplay Marco's death
yeah.
until the end, to see how hard it actually hits Hazel, in the same way that many of us will downplay our emotions and downplay our reactions to things that are deeply traumatic or deeply difficult for us until we reach a breaking point, and then show Hazel reveal that it was that big of a deal.
Yeah. And it sounds like that pacing worked for you.
It did work for me, because I think the alternative would have been fan service. I think the alternative would have been like, everyone is flipping out because Marco died and everyone loves Marco and this is a really, really big deal. I think it's swinging for the fences to do what BKV did. And I respect that. I think it takes more courage to downplay that. And I think it would have been easier. And I think most writers, probably myself included, would have tried coming back to it with the scene of, you know, Marco's funeral, or people yeah. crying, bawling over Marco's death. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where it's raining and it's dark and everyone has their umbrellas. And it's like really, you know, this supposed to be this like dark, sad, traumatic thing, and trying to pick up on where we left off, which was at a 10, right? Like, we left at a 10 in emotional height. And I think that picking up at a 10 would have been what most writers did. I am totally okay with trying to downplay it and trying to trust the audience to feel the emotional weight later on.
Yeah. And how was that end of chapter 60 for you? Those last couple of pages? I think I speak for all of us when I say that hit hard. How did that hit you when you flipped the page and just saw first the rocket ship tree on fire, but then Hazel's just utter breakdown over the next few panels and pages?
Yeah, I think it hit the way that it was supposed to. It was, I mean, to see the flashbacks and to see Hazel just like screaming daddy, and then a lot of being like, your dad's not here, like that, yeah. To see her have that complete break is, again, the type of break that we were feeling at the end of 54 and that most people probably expected 55 to pick up with. And I'm glad that it was like, patience, okay, now, like, this is when it's happening. And it gives some build up to it. I think that this arc overall is a foundation. It's a building arc. Like, nothing significant happened in this arc. We met characters that were, you know, they're going to be passing, you know, another crew of journeymen passing through this story. None of them, I think, are going to be like very, very significant. But it set a foundation that the rest of it will build on. And it ended up doing its job, I think, in getting us reinvested in the characters, reacclimated to the characters and what their personal story arcs are going to be, what their personal struggles are, and then continuing what will pretty predictably be more Brian K. Vaughan emotional manipulation.
I love that characterization of it, just straight up calling it out as emotional manipulation. You know, all storytelling is emotional manipulation, right? No matter what the tools you use and the devices you are, you're creating feelings that aren't real about characters that aren't real. And so you have to do some degree of that. And yeah, for me, this chapter just like hooked me from the very start with every bit of that. Like, as soon as Clara says in that very first panel, like, first of all, we see Clara again.
She's my favorite.
That's amazing. It's amazing to know that Clara is your favorite character. Abu's a goose guy.
Yes.
Nice. And, nice.
I go back and forth between Marco and the Will. I think I'm more of a Marco guy now. I didn't have a kid when I read this book the first time. And since the book went away and came back, I now have a daughter who's turning 5 this week. Mm-hmm. So I'm like in my feels about Marco. But seeing Clara again, and then she says the thing about, she references her own arid snatch, and it's just like, you're like, fuck yeah, Clara. Like, so you're immediately excited and elated, and then the elation just kind of builds through the whole chapter with all these little nuggets that are almost kind of fan service, right? You get the like guard in the prison with the D. Oswald Heist tattoo. So you're like, oh yes, like there's a cult of D. Oswald Heist. That's amazing. And then you get this like fan service stuff of the Chuck E. Cheese showbiz pizza scene. Abu and I talk about this in the podcast all the time, when there's stuff from our mundane world that gets represented in the saga verse, just how delightful that is.
Yep.
And Hazel has this amazing conversation with Squire about his admission or his, you know, revealing his love to her. And she handles it like an adult, like a pro-ass adult, like a kid who has had to grow up too fast, basically, is what she handles it like.
Right.
And all of that is just like affirming upon affirming upon affirming. I don't know. There's so much joy. I don't know if there was a moment of joy in that scene for you, Abu, as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first of all, I just want to call out the incredible looking water monster ice hockey game at this arcade that I really want to play. That looked like so much fun. But yeah, that whole Chuck E. Cheese scene, I mean, obviously, again, speaking to BKV's emotional manipulation, he's setting us up for the downfall of the tree on fire and the breakdown at the end by bringing us up and giving us this scene where, you know, that sort of red, we don't quite know if it's a red herring yet. We don't know if it's totally resolved, but the Squire professing his love for Hazel seems to have been solved in a pretty mature and grown-up way, where Hazel has expressed her feelings and Squire has seemingly accepted them, and they've moved on from that, presumably. And so, yeah, we're like riding this high for most of this chapter until like Jordan is saying, boom, the other shoe drops and we get to those final couple of pages. I am curious though, Jordan, there's a like among the highs that we got that we've sort of touched on in the chapter so far, did you have one that stood out for you, the one that brought you the most joy from chapter 60?
So it was going to be one of two things. One of them is the one that you just mentioned, the scene at Baked Chuck E. Cheese. Like, that's just a glorious thing.
Yeah.
But since we already mentioned that, I'll go with the other scene that stood out to me, and it's going to take some context probably to explain why it would stand out. Mm-hmm. But there's a scene where Alana and Hazel, they have their medallion and they're selling for the first time again. And Hazel is holding these two boxes in the air saying, behold, ladies and gentlemen, and other kinds of people, like basically starting to do their sales pitch. And she's really happy and she's there with her mom. And then, of course, like the police come and they have that interaction.
Yeah.
But that panel where Hazel is with her mom and happy is a good example of, similar to the Chuck E. Cheese thing, like where there's a moment of peace in happiness amongst what you know is going to be taken away, right? Like, you know that there's going to be chaos, you know that there's going to be turbulence, and it's going to be terrible, but those brief flashes of peace within all of the chaos are those things where it's like, oh, life is worth living in this moment. This is the thing that we're losing when things are turbulent. These are like the short, brief, happy moments of wonder. it makes me think of a lot of times when I'm reading Saga, emotionally, the thing that I think of is, have either of you played The Last of Us?
Oh yeah. I just finished The Last of Us 2 like a month ago.
Okay, so you are very recent in like that those feelings. Yeah. So like there's moments in The Last of Us and The Last of Us 2 where, you know, there's a giraffe in the city
moment
of quiet wonder. Or there is Ellie playing the guitar to a girl that she has a crush on.
Right.
And that's another quiet, peaceful. Like there's these moments of peace in what you know.
Ellie and Joel in the museum with the astronaut thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like there are the moments where you know it's temporary. You know it's a dark world. You know the whole shtick of this type of story is that it's going to crush your heart. Like that is the goal of these types of stories.
Yeah.
They're going to break your heart. They're going to build you up. And you know that they're going to break your heart afterwards. And those quiet moments are the ones that are, they feel peaceful. They feel like an oasis in the middle of the story. And I always like try to cherish those moments in the stories, because that will, I mean, it's a great feeling of peace and happiness, but it's also the other side of the heartbreak that I'm going to feel later on,
right, when
that peace and happiness is taken away. So I love those transition scenes, and BKV has a good number of them where, like, suddenly in the midst of all of it, you know, there's a moment of happiness and wonder.
Well, there's even, with this scene specifically, it calls back to the first scene in the first chapter from this volume, right? At the beginning of chapter 54, Hazel and Alana are out in the marketplace illegally selling their baby formula, and the cops roll up and like basically hustle them, and they lose all their product, and it's super awful. So it feels like that's what they're setting up, right? Like you get this moment of joy, and then the cops come in and they're going to fuck them up. But instead,
Alana gets out that medallion.
Display this medallion, and it's this moment of triumph. So you get those like undulating curves of emotional appeal where it's like super high peace with Hazel and her boxes. And then the cops show up and you're like, oh fuck, this is where the shoe's going to drop. But then it doesn't. Because you never want your narrative, right, to just go straight line up and then down. You want those little ripples, because that's what keeps the interest going. And it's just
keeps
all throughout.
The tension, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the callbacks, the way that this book uses callbacks is always super amazing. I don't know. Abu and I tend to gush about this story.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. I will say, so I, because apparently I felt like I needed to engage with more fan community beyond the folks that listen to this podcast, I joined, there's a Facebook group that has about 5,000 people in it that read this book. And I joined the group recently.
Yeah.
And there was, somebody posted something about this arc that had me thinking and sort of rethinking about how I feel about it. And somebody posted, quote, "Saga went from my most look forward to comic to just another in the stack." Like somehow it's like, it used to be for me, it was also, I used to look forward to this book coming out because I read this book month by month since it started in 2012. And so I used to look forward to this more than anything else. And I still look forward to it more than anything else. So I read this post on Facebook and I was like, what is it here that has folks so, I don't know, like critical of what I still think is an amazing work of art, right? Volume 10 is not my favorite volume, right? If I was going to rank all 10 volumes, 1 through 10, I wouldn't put 10, this volume as the top of that rank, but I wouldn't put it at the bottom either. So I wonder if either of you have any theories why at the end of this arc, there's a little bit of backlash that feels like it is happening, and it's weird.
I would say that it's the natural outcome of success, especially after a long break. Anytime that you're going to have a hiatus that lasts as long as it does, and you have all of the anticipation on, will it be great? Will it be great? Will it be great? Then you come back like it's going to be hard to meet people's expectations, which is again why I would go back to the bravery that it would take as a writer to not play into that and to try to have a super climactic, you know, action packed first arc returning. There's not huge things that are happening. It's playing the long game, right? So like people's reaction to, if it's a negative reaction to this fragment of the story, well, that's all it is a fragment. This is a very, very long play.
Yeah.
So it's really like, you know, staring at a piece of bark and not looking at the entire forest. So I'm very happy with the way that he approached this arc and not trying to make fan service out of it too much and not trying to make it this emotionally high thing. If you have read, like, I don't know, Why the Last Man is still, mm-hmm. like, that's the thing that I will rival Saga with, another Brian K. Vaughan series. It's, you know, the emotional rise and fall that you were describing earlier, Alan, like, that mm-hmm. is definitely present through Why the Last Man. And if you're looking at any single arc, it may or may not be your favorite arc, but it's all building towards something.
Right.
And this entire thing is building towards something. So I think that sometimes when people are offering comic criticism, and I, you know, did this myself when I was reviewing comics, it's so easy to look at a single issue and to critique a single issue, but that would be like looking at a single frame, a single, like,
yeah,
a single scene and talking about how that scene was successful or a failure when you don't know the entire context of that episode or that movie. So it's actually really lazy whenever I do that, I think, whenever other people do that. It's incredibly easy to critique a piece of something when you don't have the full picture. And we inherently in comics, since it's spoon-fed one issue at a time, don't have the full picture. You have to give a little grace there. I think you have to give a little bit of, like, I am trusting. I'm still in. I am trusting the process, and I'm going to see where this goes. If it gets uninteresting enough where you're like, I'm out, I'm bored, then okay, that comic failed for you, because at least it didn't even hold your interest to continue
right.
to see where it's going. But so long as you're still in and invested, then you're like, all right, I'm along for the journey. I'm trusting that this piece will play into a bigger picture. And I think so far, the way that this arc was written and where it ends with Hazel breaking down and understanding the weight of her father's death, the way that the audience felt that, I think that that was done really well. And that leaves me confident that, like, yes, this is, he didn't suddenly forget how to write. Like,
yeah,
there's a plan here. There's a story that's being told, and I am in the middle of that story.
Yeah. And I think, to your point, Jordan, that setup is maybe something that's also, like, people have waited years for the continuation of this story. And what we've gotten in these past few new issues in volume 10 now has been set up, right? Like, characters like Bombazine are introduced, but we don't know much about him yet.
Mm-hmm.
And these new characters are coming in. We're told that they'll play a part in Hazel's life, but they won't be around long, according to Hazel's narration in chapter 60.
Yep.
But still, we don't know a whole lot about them yet. Like, this volume and this chapter seems to honestly be sort of the resolution of Marco's death. Like you're saying, Jordan, like, the emotional resolution of his death and the setup for the rest of the story. Like, we still have dozens of more issues and chapters to go. There's much more of this story left to be told. And I completely agree with you. To judge it on one volume, on one section, is not the way to do it.
Yeah. And the one thing I would add, too, is that there's the tendency to romanticize the past. So
that's so true.
We might forget. For anyone who's, like, gone back to reread issues of Saga, like, there was a lot of equally slow moments or more. Like, there's a lot of foundation building, right? It's just that when it was so new to us, people could be more patient with that. People could be more forgiving of it, or you know, it won't bother them the same, or it bothered them a lot, and then we just, again, romanticize the past because we remember the good stuff. We remember how we felt when certain things happened and how heightened we were. But this type of pacing isn't new. This type of foundation building isn't new. It's happened a lot in this series.
Yeah, we just finished our deep dive into volume 5 on this podcast, and I would argue volume 5 is more disjointed and weirdly paced than volume 10 is, honestly. So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, and there's even the problem that lots of folks read this book binged. They binged through the volumes during the hiatus, and now all of a sudden they're forced to slow it to the pace, especially if you're not a regular comics reader. The idea of reading something, you know, 22 pages at a time feels
brutally
abysmally slow. And it's like, you know, I think that that will be a test for this book, but I really think it's the best way to read it because you ruminate on it. I'm not a fan of binge watching or binge reading, and I just think that, like, it's a really great way to dig into it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, with that little conversation out of the way about chapter 60 in this arc, we still have more to talk about, but we're going to take a quick break. But stick around, folks, because when we come back, Alan and Jordan and I are going to share our favorite panels and favorite quotes from chapter 60. So we'll see you in a minute.
And we're back. Okay, so Jordan shared with us his favorite panel already, which is great. Abu, do you want to talk about what was your favorite panel, or as we sometimes break the rules, series of panels from this particular chapter?
No, I follow the rules today. It's just one panel because I didn't have to give it a second thought. It's that gorgeous full page spread when you flip the page and the rocket ship tree is on fire, it's going up in flames, and the silhouettes of our heroes are in the foreground. All we see is just the shadows of our heroes in the front. Gorgeous panel. But I mean, like, it's an emotional bombshell, of course. We flip the page and we just see this horrible image, which actually in the previous panel is hinted at, because if you look at Squire's screen, there's like a glare. There's like a bit of a like flame glare in it. So I like that foreshadowing as well. But this panel, just gorgeous artwork. Like, once again, we rave about Fiona and her art in this story on this podcast, like every single episode. But here yet again is another testament to her skill. The shock of just turning that page and seeing that image is visceral. And I think the art adds so much more to it. I mean, I don't think I'll ever forget this like haunting image of the rocket ship tree on fire and pieces and parts of it, like these wooden chunks of it sort of falling off and falling apart. Parts of it are melting away in the flames. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's haunting. There's so much emotion packed into one image. And it's honestly like framed sort of in like a movie poster way, right? Like, you could take this one panel, blow it up, and it could be like a movie poster that lives on your wall. And I think, again, that just speaks to Fiona's skill as a storyteller through her art and her skill in hitting us with these bombshells visually. Not a single word is being spoken in this panel. It is just the wide shot visual of this horrible scene that we're witnessing.
Yeah, for me, the panels of Fiona that always strike me the most are the ones that I can hear. Like, I can hear it when I turn the page, and like I can hear the flames, and I can hear and almost like feel the heat. And like when she manages to have me have almost those sort of like multi-sensory experiences, like that's what I got from this one. And it's funny, you mentioned Stranger Things earlier, Jordan. Like, this looks like almost something from The Upside Down, right? Because like everything is all burnt out, everything is all like destroyed and falling apart. And it's that like bizarro version of this one constant. The one constant in this story, other than the characters, has been this rocket ship tree since they found it way, way, way back in volume one. And now it's ripped away in this, like, I don't know, Viking-esque funeral pyre or something like that.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking stuff. What about you, Alan? Did you have a favorite panel?
So mine, I broke the rules again. And so often in this book, the panels are like storyboards. And in this one, it's the series of panels that Fiona does of, I think you talked about this a little bit already, Jordan, the series of panels that Fiona does of Hazel's little face as she has finally like opened up the box of grief inside her own heart, and just like what seeing this thing, the one thing that has been constant through her like up and down all over the place life, is ripped away from her. And it starts out as this very like quizzical face, and then it cuts to her initial shock, and then the next face is her like eyes starting to well with tears, and then it's just the grief just rolling down her face. And you know, I reference on this podcast a fair amount, I have a small child, she's about to turn 5, and nothing else has really hit me as hard other than when Marco actually died in 54 as these panels. And this maybe even hits harder just because I see how much pain Hazel has been holding, and that like it's been Hazel's story this entire time up until now. And this is the first moment where Fiona really shows us this transition to the grief and to finally accepting the grief. And I have like welled up with some tears every time I've looked at it, including I can feel myself getting, just the power of the images.
I think I'm probably beating a dead horse at this point, but I'm just glad that the story earned that. Like you wouldn't have felt that same way if that was the first issue, or that was the first pages of Saga 55. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't stay at a 10 from years ago and then be starting at a 10, you know, in 2022. Right. It just wouldn't carry over that long. So they made us earn that by her suppressing that box of grief until it opened up at the end of the arc. I think it hit appropriately.
Yeah, you're so right. I am curious what everyone's favorite quotes are. Jordan, did you have a favorite quote from chapter 60 that really struck you?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to pass on the obvious one, which would be my girl Clara saying, I know my rights and I don't owe you a whispered tweet from my arid snatch. That would be too easy, too obvious. And that's just a good line. And there's nothing that I can comment on there narratively.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, clever and fun and Clara. Like, I love that. One of the quotes that I do like that made me think of something narratively is in the scene, she's picking up a jockstrap and Hazel is narrating and she's saying, basically not to remember their names. It goes, our rocket's latest passengers turned boarders were former bandmates, Draken and Hector.
Yeah.
But it's not like you need to remember their names or anything. They wouldn't be with us much longer. And I really like that foreshadowing for two reasons. One is that he does this quite a bit where he'll sort of mention, you know, he'll allude to the fact that someone will either leave or otherwise die. And it's a trick. So that's like one thing that I like the trick of it. And I like that it feels like a mercy emotionally. Don't get too connected. Don't get too connected. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to be with us that long. So that's one thing that I enjoy, the mercy of it. But the trick part of it is that it sets you up to look for their death or their departure. And inevitably, I mean, I usually try to avoid making predictions because I just like enjoying the ride, but I will indulge that side of my brain for a second and say, like, this is the clear head fake where while you're waiting for one of those characters to die or to leave, someone else who's going to be unexpected is going to die or leave. And that is part of the, you know, mystery game when I'm reading something like this that I know is set up to crush my spirit is he's leading me to believe it's the magician's prestige. Like, he's like, look at this hand. Something's going to happen in this hand. And in the back of my mind, I know, don't look at that hand. Something else is going to happen on the other hand. And now I just want to know what's going to happen on the other hand. Like, and am I going to be able to expect it? Am I going to be caught off guard? Like, I've been caught off guard so many times turning the page and someone's getting stabbed. Or am I going to be like, okay, this is where it's leading me to believe that something's going to happen to Guitar, and it's not going to be Guitar at all. It's going to be someone else in that scene.
Yeah, that kind of foreshadowing, BKV loves to do. He's done it before in this series as well. And that emotional manipulation, he knows how to get us.
He's good at it.
Well, we've talked about this a bunch with how he plays with future Hazel as a narrator, already knowing what the story is going to be.
Yeah.
And whether or not that makes her a reliable relator of facts, or whether she is herself filtering the narrative through her experience, right? So, like, she becomes a narrative device in herself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
As Brian K. Vaughan is using her, which is a really, really excellent tool. So you have like a third person omniscient narrator, sort of, but it's like narrator with an agenda, and it's amazing. And I love the way that he uses it. And I love you pointing that out.
And one thing I would add there is that Hazel's reliability almost, I don't know if this is actually true, but it seems like it would naturally evolve because she was a baby for so much. Like, when she's narrating some of the stuff, it's obviously not her own memory of it. It's the story that was told to her. So, you know, we're getting certain degrees of separation from the actual story. We're hearing what Hazel told and then is now telling to us. But now she's of the age where she could be telling things and actually be the one who was there for it and is telling it from a firsthand experience rather than a secondhand experience.
Right.
So earlier Hazel, theoretically, is more unreliable than the Hazel is now. And maybe the closer we get to present age Hazel, whatever that present age is, then it's, you know, we have a better idea of the person that she became, and we'll probably have a better idea of how her storytelling might be affected by all of the experiences that we've seen her go through.
Yeah, it's a good connection to what my favorite quote was, which is actually, there's a connection between a line that Hazel says as Hazel, the character in the story, that connects directly to a line of narration that came right before it. So my favorite quote is Hazel says, quote, I don't feel most things most days other than like hungry or angry or sleepy, end quote. which to me is one of the most accurate depictions of like high functioning depression. It's not like you're sad. It's not like you're like crying your eyes out. It's just like you feel everything is flat and all the richness is gone. And you're like crushing that part of yourself that allows yourself to feel. And that clearly is how Hazel has felt since Marco died. She's just like, she's not having feelings per se. She's just having reactions. And it connects directly to, there's some Hazel narration right after the scene that you were just talking about where Hazel says, even as a little girl, I could sense that mom had enough going on without also having to worry about my dumb problems. So I kept them to myself. So like within the same chapter, you have Brian saying she's keeping all of her problems to herself. And then you see directly what that's causing, which is these emotions that are being suppressed. And she has high functioning depression. And it's because she's repressing all of this grief and emotion. And so it's like, we're running into that. We're getting closer and closer to like self-aware Hazel and Hazel in the moment. And at some point they're going to have to meet. And we're going to wonder like, how are they going to deal with that? Where will that time jump happen? Or is this old granny Hazel who's been telling us this story all along and we're going to get some terrible, like, God, I was about to say How I Met Your Mother thing.
let's not speak that into existence. Don't set us up for that disappointment.
No. Abu, what about you? What was your favorite quote?
Well, that was my favorite quote too.
Oh shit!
You basically spoke exactly what I wrote down in the script as well. That quote where she talks about this like high functioning depression that she's feeling, and I think to Jordan's point about Hazel's narrator kind of becoming more and more reliable as she gets older and we see more of her internal thoughts and memories and feelings, this chapter I think sets a lot of that up. Like, I think we're going to start seeing more of internal Hazel feelings and emotions in the early chapters and in the early volumes. Hazel's really just narrating the story, like literally the narrator, and then this happened and then this thing was going to happen. Now it's like we're seeing the emotions she's going through as like a young adolescent, and the narrator is a companion to those emotions rather than just being the person who moves the story along or simply provides exposition. Like a lot of volumes 1, 2, and 3 is Hazel just explaining, there's a war, this is what Wreath is, this is what Landfall is. And there's less and less of that as we start to now turn towards more emotional Hazel and seeing more of what her internal struggles and thoughts are. And I think we're seeing the narrator sort of evolve in real time as Hazel gets older and older as well. I will also say the thing that I don't want to speak into existence, but I think is very clearly being set up, is some sort of Alana and Hazel breakup. Because in the past couple chapters, Bombazine and Alana had this argument where Bombazine was like, you're not a good mother. And that we talked about, Alan and I talked about that on this podcast, but like that stuck with me. And I think that's going to be a bug that sticks in Alana as well. And now here we're getting moments where Hazel's like, yeah, I don't really open up or talk to my mom about anything because she's got her own shit going on. She's too busy for me. To me, the fact that like Alana and Hazel are not connecting and opening up to each other in this way spells potential disaster for the two of them and their relationship. Or at the very least, a big hurdle that the two will have to work through together at some point. Because as they are now, they cannot continue not opening up to each other and speaking about their problems with each other as mother-daughter.
Yeah, if you think about it, the most stable time in Hazel's life up until this point in the book is when she was in the like weird prison for orphans of the war, right? Mm-hmm. She was with the Spider Lady teacher and like, she was not in imminent mortal peril at any point during that entire time. And yeah, that thing that Bombazine said about how Alana is always putting Hazel in danger and that makes her maybe an unfit parent. I definitely didn't want to be like, ooh, that has some...
That's a little too close to the mark, you know? Like
right now having like a small daughter, I'm like, I wouldn't want Alana to babysit my kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what stings most about that conversation with Bombazine is that it wasn't that like Hazel's always unsafe with you because your life is dangerous. It's that your life is dangerous because you're the type of person who seeks out chaos. Like you are the type of person, like we all know or have met that type of person who either from their disposition or their attitude or the decisions that they make, they just are always looking for trouble. They are always finding trouble. They are just chaos agents.
Right.
And that is largely what, like, there's, yeah, that hurts because it's true.
Yeah.
Like, she finds herself in a lot of situations. Some of them impose on her, but a lot of them are ones that were of her own decision making. And I think that that would sting for Alana and for any parent, thinking that, like, it's not just things happening to my family, it's that I am sort of walking towards these things. I am the problem here. I am the one who has something, you know, fractured in me where I'm willingly putting us in these situations.
Yeah. Tough.
Yeah. So tough. I have one more quick thing that I want all of us to offer an opinion on, which is a fan theory that I saw in the Facebook group, which if we want to dismiss it out of hand, we totally can, but I'm curious each of your responses. So there is a fan theory in the Facebook group that the reason why Alana had to shave her head after she came back from the drug dealing mission is because she had sex with the Wolfman drug dealer, even though she explicitly said that she would not have sex with him because he didn't read books. But she comes back, she has fleas, she shaved her head, and she won't talk about it. So Jordan, as our guest, having never heard that fan theory before, but I just presented it, what do you think?
Totally fair theory. I think that's a totally fair theory. I normally don't indulge fan theories, but that, I mean, her shaving her head is going to be explained. Like, that's not going to be something that just, like, oh, this random thing that is actually meaningless to the story. Like, no, that type of thing has a meaning.
Right.
And this other character who was introduced, like, who, you know, both widowers, and, like, they blatantly said that they're not going to sleep with each other. Yeah, that, I think that's a fair theory. And Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples would not hesitate to throw in a flashback sex scene of Alana and a wolf person.
Yeah. Right?
That's the type of thing that they would draw, that they would put into Saga. So I would not be surprised if that was an accurate fan theory. And I think we'll definitely, even if that's not accurate, I think we'll definitely find out the circumstances behind her shaving her head.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree with Jordan there. As much as I want to dismiss everything I see on Facebook out of hand, that rings true to me. I can see a world where that happens. And yeah, Jordan is spot on. Like, the head shaving didn't just happen for no reason.
Right.
There is going to be a reveal for that eventually at some point. So it's going to be significant. And maybe that theory is why.
Of course, because it's Facebook and everyone has to top each other, making the theory worse and worse. the next logical conclusion was not only that she had sex with the wolf person, but that she was impregnated by the wolf person.
That's
where the story is going to go.
Once you said someone one-upped it and they said the natural conclusion of that, I was like, someone's going to speculate the pregnancy. That's when I draw the line. I'm like, there has to be more actual evidence.
Right. That's not a Brian K. Vaughan thing. That's just a soap opera thing.
Right.
So-and-so exactly. Had sex and gets knocked up.
And that's a fan theory thing where you're just trying to think of the most extreme conclusion
right.
of anything that, like, whether the extreme part has evidence of it or not. Like, speculate on that type of thing when there is, you know, if Alana starts showing morning sickness symptoms or something like that. Like, okay, speculate away. But for now, I think the fair fan theory is that, like, yeah, there's definitely evidence that Alana and the wolf person whose name I can't remember was flirting, was talking about sleeping with each other, and they're both widowers, and then suddenly she comes back with a shaved head.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, Jordan, you have been very gracious with your time with us, and we hope you've had as much fun as we have. This has been a blast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is so much fun. And you don't understand. Like, it's very rare, especially with comics, to be able to have this type of conversation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, when you read comics, you'll just read them. It's not like appointment TV where everyone is watching the same thing, the same, you know, the same day or even the same week. Like, I fall behind on comics all the time.
Yeah.
To catch up. And it's really rare that I have the opportunity to talk about a comic that I recently finished reading with other people who have recently finished reading it and care about it as much as I do. So this was a ton of fun. Thanks for having me on.
A big reason we started this podcast. Alan and I were just lonely and wanted someone to talk to about Saga.
And isn't that being a nerd? Isn't that being a nerd?
I mean,
it's just like, having something that you love a lot and you want to talk about it with someone,
yeah,
but you don't have anyone to talk about it with. So you have to go find those people or you have to make those people.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
No, absolutely. Well, speaking of the bonds of nerd culture that bring us together, do you want to tell us a little bit about your book? Maybe if there's anybody who wants to hear about your own experience, your own journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is called Piccolo is Black, a memoir of race, religion, and pop culture. And the title is my favorite thing about the book. It's sort of a great, it serves two functions. Like on one hand, for anyone who grew up is particularly Black or a person of color and grew up being nerdy and watching anime, the statement that Piccolo is Black is sort of a no-brainer. It's very, very obvious.
Yeah.
It's like it's something that everyone within a certain bubble knows and recognizes and just sort of takes as fact. So that's one function of the title. But the other function of the title is the more sort of serious conversation about racial coding and characters and diversity and representation and what animation was like in the 80s and 90s and how that impacted people, which is the idea that racial coding exists and that there's a group of people who learn to racially code characters because of the lack of representation that existed in media. And there was also a larger, significantly larger group of, you know, media and fans, generally white people, who weren't thinking about these things the same way. And to introduce to those readers the idea of racial coding and how important diversity and representation was to those kids who didn't have it. So the entire thing is written through my perspective growing up and what a lot of these characters meant to me and how they informed who I became and my identity.
Just for folks who, like me, maybe did not watch, what show was Piccolo a character on?
Piccolo was a character on the anime Dragon Ball Z. So if you grew up at a certain time and you were watching, you know, Cartoon Network, you were watching Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z and Samurai Jack and Yu-Gi-Oh! And certain things like that. And Piccolo is one of countless characters who a lot of us sat down in front of the TV and saw them as a Black character, whether it's Piccolo, whether it's Martian Manhunter, whether it's Knuckles from Sonic the Hedgehog or Ursula from The Little Mermaid or Goliath from Gargoyles or Max from a Goofy movie. There are plenty of characters who were all coded as Black, even though they weren't written as explicitly Black. And there are a lot of reasons behind that. And there are a lot of impacts that came as a result of it. And the book basically touches on all of those themes through my life.
We'll make sure we drop links in the show notes to your book and to your work and to your Twitter for our listeners as well, so they can follow your amazing work and all of your great writing as well.
Thank you. Really appreciate you guys having me on the show. This was so much.
Of course. Great to have you. And you've been an amazing first guest. You have set the bar high. So the next person's going to have to really, really work their ass off to be as good as you've been. Thank you so much.
Good. I like it that way. Thank you.
Wow. Alan, what a conversation with Jordan. I had a ton of fun. I didn't expect it to get as geeky as it did there.
I didn't either. I was really, really delighted to hear just all of the reference points and really just like the sort of narrative analysis that Jordan had to offer was a lot. I mean, we might just have to make him a regular feature on this show because clearly he loves the book.
Yeah.
As much as we love the book. And he brings a perspective that is different than ours, which is the most fun thing about doing this podcast, like we mentioned, is getting to hear from, talk to, and share ideas with people who love the same thing that we do.
Yeah, definitely. There you go, Jordan. That's an open invitation to come back anytime. So next up on this podcast, we're going to be back on our grind doing our deep dive read-along episodes, and we will be starting volume 6. So make sure before the next episode comes out that you have read chapters 31, 32, and 33 in preparation for that deep dive.
Absolutely. And like we said at the top of the show, this was the last of the new chapter quick reactions that we're going to get to do until next year. Brian and Fiona! So please, let us know what other kinds of episodes you'd like to hear. Character deep dives, explorations perhaps of different inspiration for Saga. There's so many reference points that feed into this epic saga. Or maybe you want discussions of Brian and Fiona's other work. Both of these artists have so many different things they've been involved in. Maybe we could talk about those.
Yeah.
Send us an email to hazelstory@loreparty.com. And whatever you do, do not forget. the double S in the middle.
That double S. I'm still convinced there are millions of emails floating out there for us.
Millions. Millions of emails.
Well, friends, two minds can sometimes improve the odds of a podcast survival, but there are no guarantees. So leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. Music on this show was composed by Lawrence Kelly, who makes all kinds of great music. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, podcasts are fragile things. But just like Alana, Marco, and Hazel, we'll all just keep on exploring and learning together. Even if we have to wait 6 more months.
Brian and Fiona!